This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
From MaximumFun.org and NPR, it's Bullseye. My first guest this week is Michael Stipe. You know him as the lead singer of REM, one of the biggest rock bands in the history of the genre. You might also know him from his fun appearances on shows like At Home with Amy Sedaris and The Adventures of Pete and Pete. Outside of REM, which broke up in 2011, he's collaborated with Warren Zevon, Patti Smith, Billy Bragg, KRS-One, and so many others. He's been recording his own solo material lately, slowly and deliberately, when inspiration strikes. His latest single is called Drive to the Ocean.
I'll drive through the mountains, the crumbling west. I'll sing like the whales before man was a pest. Radio transistor, my friend by my side. I'll drive to the ocean I'll drive.
Michael Stipe, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jesse. I'm happy to be here.
You were a military kid. Do you remember every stop of your childhood, or were there multiple stops before you remember?
There were multiple stops before I remember, but I know each place because I've been back to most of them. But that's, you know, that for me was normal. So it felt perfectly normal for me when my father retired and I started my band to kind of keep moving at that same pace.
What's the first one that you remember?
The first place that I remember?
Yeah.
It would have been in Georgia. I think my first memory is my sister, my younger sister being born and them bringing her out into the parking lot of the hospital. And my older sister and I were sat in the back seat waiting to see her for the first time. And my second memory is a hallucination because 2 months later, my sister was born September 30th, 1962, and I was 2 years old. And 2 months later, I had contracted scarlet fever, pneumonia, and whooping cough, I think, but I almost died. And then I had a terrible reaction to the medication that they gave me for it. But my second memory is a photographer trying to get a picture of me in a Christmas sweater, and I was hallucinating. So it was like a Jack Nicholson movie, you know, from the 1960s.
How old are we talking about? Like four
two.
Or something?
I was two.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah.
It's not unusual for me to have somebody on the show that grew up a military brat. And it's such an extreme social environment because you are so bonded to whoever is traveling with you, whoever in your family is, you know, with you, your mom or whatever, or in peace, you know, your mom and dad, or, you know, depending on the mix. You're also often every 2 years or so meeting new people and doing different stuff. And there are some people who come out of that experience very socially facile, like just ready to go. Like maybe they struggle with depth, but they can just show themselves to people, be like, yep, here I am. I've done this five times before. Let's go. I don't, though, gather that was what you were like when you were a kid. Am I wrong?
I mean, I would say that, you know, possibly one of the shared experiences of people who have that type of childhood or lifestyle growing up, you know, your family become very, very important because they are your anchor, much more than the community or the group of friends that you might make at school or out of church or in your neighborhood. And so, you know, I'm very lucky that I have a great family. I had a great father growing up, and I have this very loving, very intimate, and very close relationship with my sisters. And so, but I do think that a lot of that had to do with us picking up and moving all the time.
Night swimming deserves a quiet night.
life on the dashboard, taken years ago. Turned around backwards so the windshield shows. Every street light reveals a picture in reverse. Still, it's so much clearer. I forgot my shirt at the water's edge. The moon is low tonight.
When did you figure out that you might be a weird kid?
Weird. Okay.
Well, I picked that one out of a long list of possibilities, but alternative seemed a little on the nose.
Okay. No, I figured out queer pretty early on, and then had to figure that out because the categories that were available to me didn't exactly match how I felt, and so that was a bit odd, but I was the daydreamer. I was a kid that looked out the window. I'm the only boy of three kids. I'm the middle kid. I'm left-handed. I'm queer, as it turns out. So there's all these, and a military kid. So there's all these things that are maybe different from what other people, quote unquote, normal upbringing might provide. But that's not so different, huh? I don't know that I ever. Maybe, you know what? I bet I know what it was. I think probably. I could always emotionally read a room, even as a very, very young child. And so there would be things going on that kids didn't need to know about. But I would look at the adults and see that something was wrong. So I would pull someone aside and say, what's happening? And they would routinely separate me from the other kids and say, so-and-so's had an accident, and it's because of some bad men that he met during the war. And we're talking about a distant family member, not my father, but who had a car wreck, and it's because he had been drinking, and this was in the early 60s. But that's a good example, though. I mean, I think I knew then that, you know, I'd go back and all the kids would be playing, and no one else seemed to have tapped into this emotional dissonance that for me was absolutely like present in the room, like a fog. And the parents or the adults would always, in my family, they would treat me with respect in terms of how they answered those questions. You know, it's a very different time than what a parent might say to a kid now, but they did their best and they did a good job. Maybe that's when I realized that I was a little bit different from those around me.
And that was a particular real life example that you just gave?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How old were you?
I would have been, that was probably 5 or 6.
That is really young to notice something like that.
Well, I mean, that's just who I am. It's okay. I'm fine. I turned out okay.
What about the queer part of it? Because you've had romances with, you have a partner who's a man right now, I think, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
But you've had romances with women as well.
That's right.
When did you realize something, and what did you realize?
Pretty early on. I mean, I think maybe as a young teenager, probably around 12, 13, 12, I would say. Yeah. No, earlier. I'm placing it now where I lived at the time. So that's always a nice way, because I know what years we moved from so-and-so to so-and-so. So it would have been earlier than that, probably 11, 10.
What did you notice?
I'm going backwards, aren't I? Maybe 7. That's, I consider my...
Okay, 4 is my final offer.
I consider my first sexual experience that I remember, I was either 6 or 7 years old, and that happened in Germany. It was with a brother-sister team. I still have a thing for redheads, as it turns out. And they were a good bit older than me, and I think they had more of an idea of what they were doing. And it was completely fine. I don't think it had any bad impact on me, but I do remember it.
Yeah, I mean, what did you even know about what that meant at the time?
I didn't know anything. I mean, there wasn't much to...
I mean, like, the thing that I thought about when I thought about that was, like, it's one very difficult trauma to go through. I'm supposed to be this, but actually I'm this when you're gay. And, you know, like, I know what I'm supposed to be, and it's definitely wrong. But it seems like a very different thing to be in a similar position and maybe, you know, not even know that that people who are queer who aren't gay exist, you know, bi people or poly people or whatever. And you're just like, it's just a lot of extra stuff to sort out.
Well, I mean, and I don't know that wrong is the right term, because when you're in it, it doesn't feel wrong. You just realize that the people around you or the culture that you're moving through might not recognize how right it is, rather than it being wrong for you. But I'm just so thrilled that the 21st century has arrived at a place that I feel like I've been beating that drum for a real long time, that there is a sliding scale of desire and attraction. And we've arrived at a place where that's completely acceptable and wonderful. And in fact, has opened our minds up to a lot of concepts that I think in the 20th century were much more kind of beaten down into these very binary categories that didn't really serve not only people that felt outside of that, but even the people that maybe didn't ever have to think about it because they did feel served by it. Well, it's a quite limiting way to move through the world if everything is black and white, if everything is that like hot and cold or yes and no. So, I'm just thrilled that the 21st century has put us where we find ourselves now culturally, and there's a whole different level of understanding about these things.
Even more still to get into with Michael Stipe after the break. Back in a minute. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu. Support for NPR and the following message come from Jarl and Pamela Moan, thanking the people who make public radio great every day and also those who listen.
When voters talk during an election season, we listen. We ask questions, we follow up, and we bring you along to hear what we learned. Get closer to the issues, the people, and your vote at the NPR Elections Hub. Visit npr.org/elections.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Michael Stipe, the lead singer of REM. In its 31-year existence, REM sold over 85 million albums, topped numerous best album lists, and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. REM broke up in 2011. Stipe has since been working on photography, collaborating with artists like Aaron Dessner and Justin Vernon, and recording his own material, too. Here's another song. This is Your Capricious Soul.
Honey's got a new feeling. Honey peeled herself off the ceiling. Because God is revealing how to serve your body, how to serve your mind.
Did you make music when you were a kid?
My earliest memory I sang when we lived in Germany, so I would have been 6 or 7 years old then. I was given a solo part in a Christmas pageant, I think, and my teacher, Mrs. Fujimoto, pulled my mom aside for a variety of reasons. One, because I was left-handed, and then she wanted to find out if they needed to train me to write with my right hand, and my mom said absolutely not. Two was, should we medicate little Johnny Mike? And my mother said, absolutely not. And then I needed help with spelling because I wasn't good with that. But when I would sing, I would stand on the sides of my feet. I wouldn't stand flat-footed, but I would kind of... So Mrs. Fujimoto and my mom rehearsed with me my part so that I would stand flat-footed when it was my turn to sing. Well, the night came, the big pageant, the big Christmas pageant, and I stepped forward as I was supposed to do, and I started singing my part. But what we didn't do in rehearsal was there weren't lights, and so a spotlight came on to me. I remember it, Jesse, as if it was yesterday. It was such a magnificent feeling. to have that spotlight, but it surprised me. And so I stood on the side of my feet and for the whole part, but I did hit the notes and I finished my part and stepped back into the choir.
Not only the context of that story, but like the physical feeling of that story. I know exactly what you mean, the difference between standing on different parts of your feet. Like, I can understand why that aspect of the story is so vibrant to you even now.
It's such a kid thing, right? But also just the power of the spotlight, my goodness. I mean, and I certainly carried that into adulthood, huh?
And you were into it?
Well, yeah, but it, I mean, it's thrilling. You know, there it is. That's boom. There it is. I mean, I think I sing about it in what song? Losing My Religion. Not a bad point of reference there. Of course, that's not an autobiographic song at all, but you understand what I'm saying. It's powerful to have that amount of attention on you, and you're there to perform something, to do something that's going to make people feel a certain way. That there's immense power in that.
How did you figure out that there was, cool punk rock music in some places?
I was in detention when I was 14, I want to say. Someone had left a Cream magazine under the desk that I was sat at, and I picked it up and started reading it. And there was an article about the CBGB scene, the nascent punk rock scene in New York City, with a picture of Patti Smith. And I looked at that photograph, and I was like, that's, wow, like, that's where I want to be.
Do you remember what about it?
She just looked really, like, compelling. Otherworldly, alien. She looked alien. The article was written by Lisa Robinson, who's now a friend of mine. And Patty is, of course, now a friend. And I've met a lot of the people that were in bands then, or I performed with the Ramones with my former band, R.E.M., in Europe on tours in the 1980s and 90s. I've had the privilege to be able to meet a lot of the people that were really my teenage heroes, and in some cases develop quite close friendships. But that just turned me around. I mean, that was it. I was 15 when Patty's first album came out, and I bought it the day it came out, and I just never really looked back.
What was the first, like, actual place you were, or like person you were hanging out with, or like physical thing in your actual life, rather than a thing you were reading about or receiving indirectly, where you are like, oh, well, this works. This is the thing that I wanted. This is the thing I read about.
I created a community around my interest in punk rock, set me apart, but no one else. I was going to high school then in Collinsville, Illinois, which is just outside of East St. Louis, which is just across the river from St. Louis. And so no one there had any idea of any of this. I created that community. I turned on some kids that were my age and a little bit older, who were really, really cool kids. We were like Rumblefish, and I was the guy with the I was the nerd with the glasses, and they were like the guys who protected me because they were really cool. One of them had an older brother who dealt drugs, and he was really, really cool. And they were just really cool. And so they kind of protected me, and I introduced them to this whole world that no one there knew about. So in a way, I kind of created that community myself. I mean, I remember going to parties with punk rock albums under my arm, and someone would throw a garage door open, and they'd have a turntable, and you would play records, and people would bring their records and listen to them, and nobody wanted to hear what I had to bring. I remember making, this is really embarrassing, but kind of amazing. I made mimeographed, and because Kinko's didn't exist at the time, Xerox existed, I guess, but we called them mimeographs. I mimeographed posters that I made on 8x10 paper that said Tom Verlaine is God, Tom Verlaine being the lead guitarist and singer for the band Television from the CBGB scene. No one in my high school knew who Tom Verlaine was, but it caused this huge ruckus because it was blasphemous to call anyone God except for God. But then all the English teachers were like, it's Paul Verlaine. Like, they didn't know they thought it was the romantic poet from France, not some guy from the, some guy from the Bowery. But anyway.
What did your dad, the last in a long line of Methodist preachers, think about it?
My father wasn't a Methodist preacher. My grandfather was.
The end of the long line of Methodist preachers, I should say.
They never caught the vandal. You know, the vandal was me, of course. But they never caught the vandal. So my father didn't hear about it. Nobody's heard about it until this interview, I don't think. That's pretty funny to admit, but there it is. What I wouldn't give to have one of those Tom Verlaine is God mimeograph sheets now.
When did you feel like you were there? Was it when you got to art school?
What is there? What do you mean there?
I mean, like that you were inside the thing that you imagined being inside. I mean, you weren't literally inside of CBGB's scene.
No,
at the time, you're 1,000 miles away from that. But art school is a whole other deal.
I didn't feel like I was inside of it then either. I have to say, Jesse, I was still. You know, I was very, very shy. And yeah, I didn't, I mean, the early punk rock scene in Athens, Georgia, which is where I moved when I was 18 to go to college, was really incredible. But I was kind of an outsider there. I do remember there was a party that, and it was, you know, the band Pylon, the Method Actors was a band here in the late 70s, early 80s, the B-52s. The kind of group of friends that were around the B-52s. There was a punk rock party that was happening at someone's house on some weekend night. And I was at the local lesbian bar, and I had taken a Quaalude, and I was bad-mouthing some guy. I don't even remember who he was, but I didn't like him for some reason. And I was really high, and I didn't realize I was bad-mouthing him to his best friend. So the guy clocked me and knocked me off a truck, and I got a bloody nose. And then I went to the punk rock party. So I showed up and I was the youngest person there, and I had blood all down the front of my shirt. And they just thought that was very punk rock, you know? And so I think I that was like my in into that crowd. Part of it was really sweet because they just wanted to clean me up and like make sure I was okay. But part of it, I think they were a little bit like, wow, this is the real thing. Anyway, I don't think anyone's ever heard that story either. I have to thank Vanessa Briscoe from the band Pylon. She was the singer of that band, and she was particularly kind to me.
Did you really want to be a performer? The way you describe being in the spotlight, I was like, oh, okay. He was not the kind of shy where he didn't want to perform. He was the kind of shy where he knew he wanted that but had to figure out how to do it.
Yeah. I really can't answer that. I mean, I don't know what I was thinking, except that I just wanted to be in a band and I wanted to do that. It didn't occur to me that, you know, and I've said this a million times, but it didn't occur to me that I would have to learn how to sing. I would have to learn how to or play an instrument. I sang because I couldn't play anything. So I was like, I'll be the singer. And I wanted most of the attention. So that's where you get most of the attention. But you know, if you listen to really, really early recordings, and please don't, you know, I sang like a rockabilly singer. It's all that I, you know, I knew Elvis Presley. So that's what I sang like. And I thought it was kind of, I didn't have a vocal style. I have said before that my vocal style developed when Mike, Peter, and Bill, the other members of R.E.M., were playing so fast that I couldn't keep up. And I thought it was too fast and they wouldn't slow down because they wanted to play really fast. So I just started slowing down my part. And that developed into a vocal style, I think, that where I held my vowels longer than you're supposed to. You know, we get that now from early Drake, but people weren't really singing like that back then.
There's also a kind of quality in the earlier REM things of both like an aesthetic choice that suggests a kind of timelessness and placelessness, and also that maybe in your particular part of it, it feels like you are, you know, you're beyond that, hiding a little bit.
Beyond,
beyond just trying to be unplaceable. You know what I mean? Like, it's both of those things at the same time. You're kind of retiring. You're withdrawing a little bit.
Well, we, you know, as a group, let's talk about that first, because I think that's important. We had a distinct set of limitations, each of us, and those limitations allowed us to. One of the rule of no was one of the things that REM always, we always knew what we didn't want. And I, as a singer and as a performer and even as a public figure, I know exactly what I don't want. I sometimes step into it and then I've got egg on my face, but I know how I don't want to come across. I know what I don't want to write. I know what I don't want my voice to sound like. I know that I don't want it to do that, that kind of, throat scratchy, calisthenic kind of vocal thing too many times, because that's just dumb and sounds insincere. So there was a lot of us being extremely limited, and then taking those limitations and really pushing them as far as we could. And within that, in a group dynamic, creating something that really was very, very new. And I don't know how timeless it wound up being. I listened to it now, and it's hard for me to objectively listen to our past work, but I'm able to recognize stuff that I think is really supremely great, and then stuff that is, you know, for me, deeply embarrassing or not so great, or might could have used one more edit, you know, or one more pass at the third verse, you know. Anyway, I am my greatest critic in that regard, but I try not to look back that much. I understand that the work is out there. Once a song is released into the world, it belongs to everyone else and not to me. And so that, you know, it's not my place to badmouth my past work at all.
We'll wrap up with Michael Stipe after a quick break. When we return, he'll tell us about the song he's most proud of writing. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card, issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval, terms apply.
You're in a theater, the lights go down. You're about to get swept up by the characters and all their little details and interpersonal dramas. You look at them and think, that person is so obviously in love with their best friend. Wait, am I in love with my best friend? That character's mom is so overbearing. Why doesn't she just stand up to her? Oh God, do I need to stand up to my own mother? If you've ever recognized yourself in a movie, then join me, Jordan Cruciola, for the podcast Feeling Seen. We've talked to author Susan Orlean on realizing her own marriage was falling apart after watching Adaptation, an adaptation of her own work, and comedian Hari Kondabolu on why Harold and Kumar was a depressingly important movie for Southeast Asians. So join me every Thursday for the Feeling Seen podcast here on Maximum Fun.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Michael Stipe, the lead singer of REM. Let's get back into our interview. What's something that you heard yourself do or heard on an REM record, you know, sometime in the last few years where you thought, gosh, I forgot about that. That is great. Like, that really worked.
Well, I can tell you, I mean, that's an easy one for me. I think one of the best songs we ever wrote was on one of the later records. And they were just, you know, in America particularly, audiences were kind of over us. They were done with us. They were tired of me or my persona or had moved on to other things. But there's a song called Supernatural, Super Serious, which I think is one of the best things we ever wrote.
Everybody here comes from somewhere that they just as soon forget and disguise.
I sing it in my head all the time. I really like the chorus, and there's a thing that I do at the end that is some of my best work. It's nice to be able to say that. I mean, that's one thing about doing what I've done and what I did for so long, is that I can kind of look at the work and be proud of it and say, I know that that's really, really quality. I know that that's really good. I won't talk about the things that are bad. I'll talk about them abstractly, but I'm not going to say this song off of this record is just a deep, horrible embarrassment for me, because someone might use that song in their wedding, or it might be their favorites. It might be the song that they fell in love to. It's not mine to say that anymore, you know, but I can talk about the triumphs.
What was it like for you to have the life rhythm of being a performing musician when REM started? Like, say, the first 5 years or so before you had hit records, but when you were working really, really hard, you know, there's things about it that are similar to the kind of peripatetic military kid lifestyle. But like, there's also a real pattern of intensity and then slowdown that is kind of all consuming.
I was born hyperactive, and that pace of those first early years, traveling around in a van, starving, having exactly one outfit to wear, you know, having to share everything with the other guys, not having any money, not having any means of support, not knowing what we were doing next, not knowing anything about where it was going or what it might become. It fed that hyperactivity and also the adrenaline that comes with performing, the adrenaline that comes from being in that spotlight, however small that spotlight might be, is something that I absolutely fed off of. There are, of course, very negative aspects to that. And particularly if you do it again and again and over and over and over again, you've got to really take care of yourself, or you're going to flame out.
Did you have any sense of what you had to do to take care of yourself?
Really not until much later. I mean, I went through a very rough period in the mid-80s where I had about a year and a half long nervous breakdown. And that had to do with a lot of things. When I came through that, I felt a deeper sense of purpose, because I felt like I had come very close to death or to just not ever coming back, you know? And so some good songs came out of it for sure. But I had, there was a confidence and there was a purpose that was not there before. Before that, I think I was really just enjoying the ride and enjoying learning how to write and learning how to sing and finding my voice and learning how to be a public figure as well, which was really not very easy, particularly then. You know, this is a generation where, you know, selling out was something that was considered like the worst possible sin. And it's a very, very different to the way today's generation might approach pop music or performing or being a public figure. and so that came with its own set of difficulties.
What kind of nervous breakdown was it? Was it depression or psychosis or exhaustion? Or
it was depression. It was exhaustion as well. But my adrenals were tapped out, and I had no way to fix that. I didn't know how to fix it. I was worried for my own life. I was convinced that I was HIV positive. There was no way for me to test that at the time. And I wasn't sure that I wanted to be a pop star. I wasn't sure I wanted to be a public figure. I wasn't sure I wanted to be traveling like that or doing any of the things that we were doing. You know, it was just, it all compounded to create a really bad situation for me. And the band didn't realize it at the time, and neither did I. I didn't know what depression felt like. I'd never been through it before. But this was very real. And I came through it eventually. But I mean, the story of how I came out of it is quite intense. And, you know, we don't need to talk about it here. It was a very intense, difficult thing that happened to me. And then I came out of it. And then I had, as I said earlier, this deep sense of purpose that I don't think that I had before. You know, before it was really just a lot of fun. And then it was pressure fun. And then it was pressure fun, but with the specter of AIDS hanging over my head. And then pressure fun with the specter of AIDS and the exhaustion that comes from being in a continually adrenalized state. And at that point, I stopped doing drugs years before and stopped drinking. And so it was really, you know, it wasn't brought about by anything like that. But it was dark. It was very dark.
What was the purpose that you found?
That's a good question. I mean, I think just to believe in myself and to be who I am and to, I don't know. I mean, I suddenly I just felt elevated and free of the concerns and the fears that I had gone through. I flew very, very, very close to, that's I'm mixing metaphors, which I'm the king of, but it got as dark as it could possibly get. It could not have gotten darker. And then this thing happened and I was in literal darkness for 10 days. And then I came out of it and I could see again and I was not blind and I was alive. And I was very grateful and very thankful for that.
Were you working during that time?
Oh yeah, we didn't stop working. There's some good records that came out of it, truthfully. Fables of the Reconstruction was during that time period. And then the tour that was Reckoning from the second album came out of that.
Well, Michael Stipe, I'm so grateful to you for taking all this time to talk to me. We could talk for 4 more hours about different stuff, and I'm very grateful that you took this time.
Thank you, Jesse. Thanks for having me on.
Michael Stipe, he's working on even more solo material to be released soon, so keep an ear out for it. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye, created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. You know, there's a light on the porch outside my home office here, and there's been a little birdie hanging out over there. It's pretty nice. I mean, I'm not like a full-on bird guy now, but I wish the bird the best. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers, Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Tabitha Myers. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, who's also known as DJW. Our theme music is by the Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation. Thanks to the Go Team for sharing it with us and to their label, Memphis Industries Records. Go Team, great band. It's from a great record. Check them out. Bullseye also on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. Find us there. Give us a follow. We'll share with you all of our interviews. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Lisa in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
In this country, some truths aren't self-evident. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as wide-ranging and real as the people who tell them, we celebrate the Black experience for all its soul and richness. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.